Hello and welcome to the Friday, June 24th, 2022 edition of On Iowa Politics. On the podcast this week, yet another key abortion ruling from another Supreme Court. Iowa's Republican U.S. Senators split their votes on gun legislation. And Iowa Democrats make their pitch to preserve their first-in-the-nation status and more. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Murphy, Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. With me today are Gazette Deputy Bureau Chief Tom Barton. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Aaron.
Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal. Good morning, Jared.
There are weeks where decades happen, Aaron.
Right? No problem filling the podcast this week. I feel like we just need the last 48 hours, much less the whole week. And also with us today, our Gazette opinion editor, Todd Dorman. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
So we start this week in a similar fashion to last week, and God bless these Supreme Courts and the timing of their rulings, which, again, dropping literally moments before we press record on the podcast here. This time it's the U.S. Supreme Court, which issued its much-anticipated ruling on a couple cases, and that ruling in essence did what we have been suspecting and expecting ever since the draft leak from a few weeks ago, is that the U.S. Supreme Court has overturned Roe versus Wade, the landmark 1973 ruling that made abortion a federally guaranteed right. The ruling essentially, I shouldn't say essentially, it says it right in the text, punts the issue of abortion back to the states. So what we'll have now moving forward is state action on a state-by-state basis, regulating slash banning abortions. So again, hot off the press, fresh info. So we are giving you our hottest and freshest takes here, barely a hour or so to consume this information. Tom, let me start with you real quick. From a reporting side of thing, you've been monitoring the reaction out there from folks around Iowa, advocacy groups, elected officials. Tell me what you're hearing. I guess we could start with, I don't expect any. Were there any surprises in anything that you've heard coming from the folks who have issued statements on this ruling?
No, I mean, the responses are the ones that, you expected. GOP lawmakers, leaders celebrated the reversal as, abortion rights supporters decried the ruling. It's important to note, though, that no restrictions went into effect in Iowa with the court ruling. Abortion remains legal in the state up until 20 weeks. But again, as I mentioned, Republicans in the state celebrated the ruling, including Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. She talked about how this ruling, upholds an enduring truth that all human beings without exception are created equal, according to her statement. And she went on to say that the fight for life is not over, and that as governor, she will not rest until every unborn Iowan is protected and respected. We also saw statements from U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, who's also the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and applauded the ruling in a statement describing the reversal as a correction of flawed legal analysis. He said that, quote, "This ruling does not ban the practice of abortion, but instead empowers the people through their accounted elected representatives to make common sense policy decisions, and that it takes policymaking, out of the hands of unelected judges," end quote. Iowa Democrats responded by saying that, the fight to protect reproductive rights in Iowa is not over, and that Iowa law still gives Iowans final say in making their own healthcare decisions, including abortion. Iowa House Democratic leader, Jennifer Confirst, talked about that, you know, while today's ruling is tough and it might feel hopeless, again, this fight is not over. She talked about how a large majority of Iowans still believe in reproductive freedom, and says that, you know, everyone deserves the right to decide when to start a family, and says that she's going to, quote, fight like hell every single day to make sure that every family in Iowa keeps their right to access safe, legal abortions.
Todd, let me go to you next. And I say this as a State House reporter. The question now in Iowa is not whether Iowa Republicans will restrict abortions in some way, right? The question is to what extent and how soon. Am I right there?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's pretty clear from the governor's statement that she intends to try to ban abortion in Iowa. I mean, when you say that, what did she say? She's going to protect and respect every unborn life. I mean, it's pretty hard to do that by, you know, doing something less than an outright ban. So I think, you know, if she wins re-election and the legislature remains in Republican hands, which are both, you know, the likely outcomes, I would expect some sort of ban on abortion in Iowa to be voted on and probably signed by the governor. I don't think they're going to go in before the election. I could be wrong.
That was going to be my other question. Do you think they'll do a special session?
I don't. I think they see this as a really, you know, an important issue for the members of their party. But, you know, beyond that, it's also going to make some problems, especially, you know, in suburban areas and other places where, all places really, where women who valued this individual freedom are now watching it being taken away and know that if Republicans, you know, continue to control state government, that it's going to go away in Iowa too. So this is this is for Republicans, it may be one of those, be careful what you hope for, because now there's an issue out there that's big and may not, and the political wind may not blow in their direction. I mean, I know they want this all to be about, you know, inflation and gas prices, but this is a pretty big deal.
I do kind of wonder too about the timing of when we might see something, because more than it, like, obviously as a party, this is an issue Republicans care greatly about. And then there are degrees to which, like, they care about it and make it their most important thing, with, you know, folks like in my neck of the woods, Skylar Wheeler being one of the staunchest people. And with some of those legislators, if you, you know, genuinely believe that abortion is murder and it's ending innocent lives, I would think that might actually hasten you to act as quickly as possible and maybe even throw out waiting until after the election. So I am curious to kind of see what they decide to do with that.
Yeah, and I'm going to plagiarize myself and something I said last week on Pints and Politics, and hopefully y'all in the Cedar Rapids area made it out to that, and if you didn't, we'll make it to the next one. What's interesting to me is, as Todd mentioned, you know, the governor is favored to win again. Republicans are favored to keep their majorities. The legislature, it's exceptionally hard to see anything changing there because of the wide majorities that the Republicans have in both the House and the Senate. The governor's race, Kim Reynolds is the favorite, but I think it would be dangerous for anybody to assume that race is a foregone conclusion. And so that's what's interesting to me about this and watching the next few weeks and months, is that because it's a something of a leap of faith or political calculation for our Republicans, right? Because if they assume all those things and say, we'll take care of that next session, and if Governor Reynolds does not win re-election, that opportunity is gone. Deidre DeGeer is not signing off on any abortion legislation, right? So the way I phrased it during Pints in Politics is, if we don't see a special session, to me, that says Kim Reynolds' campaign's internal polling shows her with a 10 or 15 point lead.
I was just going to jump in here real quick and say that that Governor Reynolds and GOP leadership in the Iowa legislature have been silent on the issue of a special session. We have reached out to the governor's office and we have reached out to legislative leaders, and they've not responded to messages, and they've not said whether they will call a special session this summer to take up a new abortion law.
Yeah, and for the benefit of the listening audience, sorry, Todd, we're at about 11:30 a.m. Friday morning as we tape here. Go ahead, Todd.
Well, you know, one of the advantages that Republicans believe they have in Iowa is that there's an enthusiasm gap, that they're enthused. They're going to go on a red wave. It's going to be a big election for Republicans, and that Democrats are demoralized. They're not as well organized. To call a special session this year would certainly give Democrats a rallying point and also sort of a moment to, you know, stoke the fires of their, you know, of their political organizations. And as I say, if you look at the polling, this banning abortion is not particularly popular in Iowa. So to do something unpopular that would fire up the Democratic Party and put a focus on, you know, that they're going to be the ones protecting, you know, women's reproductive rights, I'm not sure that would be a good political calculation. But, you know, as has been said, I mean, if they feel strongly about it, as many of them do, they may decide that, you know, that's the right thing to do.
Even from like a political calculation standpoint, do you think they should even care that much about Democrats getting fired up? Because at least from, you know, voting in the primaries, there are a lot more Republicans voting in like the Senate race than there were in the Democratic race and so on.
Yeah, I don't think they're worried. I don't think they would be worried so much about necessarily about Democrats getting fired up. What they might be worried about is that the whole political theater of coming back for a special session to ban abortion would strike at, you know, a lot of voters sort of in the middle, independents, women independents who aren't, you know, maybe might have voted for Kim Reynolds in 2018, are looking at this saga and saying, you know, the Republicans really aren't representing my best interest. And not only that, you know, right before an election, they're going to come in and ban abortion. So then my choice, you know, the voter's choice doesn't count to them. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, nominating a Supreme Court justice and, you know, confirming her 7 days before the election. I mean, people, the idea that you're going to do this before people have a chance to go to the polls also is going to rub people the wrong way.
But did you, Todd, that, and that's interesting that that's the example you use. And I almost, let me punt it back to you. Did you not actually make a case against your own argument there? Because they did that and that didn't hurt them. Voters didn't punish them for that.
Well, Donald Trump lost. So, I mean, there was that.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing, let me ask you again, Todd, because this is fascinating to me. Democrats are going to make this an issue either way, right? I mean,
sure.
Regardless of whether they do the special session or not. So I guess is what you're saying is that it's better to have that debate about what you might do next year as a Republican versus actually having done it and taken that action right before an election is.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And Republicans over the years, you know, especially in recent years, have been pretty good at running campaigns that didn't really say much about what they actually intend to do once they take office. And so I would expect this to be sort of one of those issues that they talk about at the, you know, loudly at the Sioux County pancake breakfast, but when they're in Urbandale, they might not bring it up so much. I mean, I think I think they're probably better off keeping things sort of fuzzy than saying this is exactly what we're going to do. We're going to ban abortion. We're going to make it a felony for a doctor to perform one. You know, here are all the details of what we want to do. You know, and people, you know, once you do that, then you've got a really clear target.
You know, Todd, you just gave me pre-PTSD a thing because you just gave me flash forwards to Jack Whitfer and Pat Grassley saying over and over over the next 4 months, well, we've got an election and we'll talk to the caucus in and see what the caucus wants to do. I can already write that.
The legislature is probably going to be more conservative. I mean, we had some of these primary battles that were fought over abortion, and the people who wanted more stringent restrictions won those primary races. So,
yeah.
I mean, some of the people that you, I guess, would pass for moderate these days are not going to be around. So that'll.
But they would be for the special session, which is interesting.
Well, and that, that's a good point. I hadn't considered that. So yeah, there's another reason they might decide not to go that way. Yeah. But they'd still have the votes to pass stuff. I mean, I think definitely. Sure.
I had two different little data points I took note of that might be helpful context. And one of them literally was this morning as the Supreme Court decision happened. There was a Gallup poll that came out that found that 25% of U.S. adults have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the Supreme Court, which is down from 36% in 2021 and is an all-time low. And it's one of those things that's worth tracking because, you know, the way America tends to work is that change a lot of times happens incrementally. I don't know if that would necessarily hold true if Americans continue to lose faith in pretty much every institution that's supposed to be keeping this whole thing together. I do wonder then if some of these changes might start happening even quicker.
Yeah, well, and I mean, decisions like this are going to make the U.S. Supreme Court look like the legal arm of the Republican Party to most people. I mean, you had a decision yesterday that basically tells blue states they can't regulate firearms or concealed firearms. Now you've got a ruling today that says red states can ban abortion. I mean, they're basically just imposing the Republican agenda on blue states and allowing the agenda to move forward in red states. I mean, this is not going to strike people as, you know, sort of impartial weighing of constitutional jurisprudence. It's going to look like they're doing the bidding of one party, and that is going to hurt their credibility, as you suggest it already has.
Yeah, if they're not careful, they're going to get down in the approval numbers of Congress, and God forbid, maybe even the media.
I mean, and they won't even have the, you know, I hate Congress, but I like my congressman. I don't have a Supreme Court justice to like. Who's my favorite? I don't know. Well, and also, you know, the other thing about that ruling is Clarence Thomas did a solo concurrence where he basically said this should open the door to looking at marriage and contraceptives and gay marriage. I mean, where's this? This is we're headed down a fairly dangerous path.
Amazing stuff. And to paint a picture here for the listeners, I hadn't even heard that part yet. I literally saw the breaking news just before we headed on set to record Iowa Press this morning. I hadn't even heard that specific part. So that's that's something. And let me put a pin on this for now, and we'll obviously have more to say about this in future podcasts. But I think Tom raises a good point that's important to remind folks that as everything that's happening for the moment, as of right now, current state law stands, abortions are legal in Iowa at the moment up until 20 weeks, and that remains the case. So if there's any women out there listening and are wondering what that means in the immediate future, nothing changes for now, and we watch to see what will change, and again, when it will change. So we'll be back to talk about that in future podcasts, without a doubt. Next up this week, it was the hot story, and it's all of about not even 48 hours old, and is already last month's news. But the U.S. Senate this week passed legislation designed to address recent mass shootings at schools, churches, and other public spaces. The bill passed the Senate Thursday night and is headed to the House. Depending on when you're listening to this podcast, they may have already voted on it, and maybe to President Biden's desk. It sounded like that thing was going to move and happen quickly. The bill doesn't go nearly as far as gun control advocates would have hoped, but it is nonetheless also being called by some of those same advocates the most significant gun violence legislation in decades. we're in Iowa, so let's talk about that. 15 Senate Republicans voted for the bill from Iowa. Joni Ernst was among those 15 who did vote for it. Chuck Grassley was not. He voted a no. And as by way of background, really quick, the bill creates a more robust background check for 18 to 20 year olds who buy an AR-15, allows law enforcement to ask a judge to take guns away from an individual who's been convicted of domestic violence. That's the so-called boyfriend loophole. Makes federal funding available to states to encourage them to pass red flag laws, and it funds various school safety and mental health care programs. So, Todd, let's start with you on this one, and let me ask you, as we look at Senator Grassley's no vote against and Senator Ernst's vote for the bill, let me start with the most cynical question. Is this just Occam's razor? Is it the simplest explanation that Chuck Grassley voted no because he faces re-election this fall and didn't want to upset his base, and that Joni Ernst voted for it because she doesn't face re-election for four more years?
Yeah, that's probably the right answer. I mean, it was a fairly, it's a fairly mild, package of gun violence efforts, and Joni Ernst, who had been in the past, had been against the closing the boyfriend loophole because she had, concerns about due process. She voted for the bill, and now basically Grassley is parroting what Ernst used to say about the boyfriend loophole, and voted against and found it as a reason to vote against the bill. So that's interesting. I think U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson also expressed the exact same reservations about the bill, and I don't know when and if they voted, but it sounds to me like maybe she was going to vote no. And also, it wouldn't surprise me if the whole delegation did, but who knows? I do think election year politics has something to do with it. I mean, and we've said before, his little known opponent got 26% of the vote, and he also took a lot of flack for voting for the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which gave Joe Biden a win. So I think he's being cautious.
Yeah, there's a sliver of us that talks about bipartisanship as the goal in Congress, and it's easy to forget sometimes that in a lot of corners of the political world, that's actually a dirty word these days. Jared, this issue had already taken on some life in Iowa's U.S. Senate campaign. I think it's pretty safe money to wager that Democratic challenger Mike Franken will make an issue of Grassley's vote on that campaign. What's your gut tell you about the extent to which that will be a factor with voters? How much does, and I should say here again, like everything else, I wrote that question before everything that happened this morning. So obviously there's that entering this realm too, but we're on gun control now. So what's your gut tell you about whether that's a move the needle type issue in this campaign?
So yeah, with the abortion ruling today, and inflation concerns not going away anytime soon, and this gun legislation looking like it's close to the end zone, it's maybe a little more difficult now to envision gun control being the issue with the most salience in the general election. Now, like with that said, I do think Franken will continue to bring this up, and that's for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is he's able to speak with more authority about firearms than Grassley, who himself has said in appearances it's been decades since he's even shot a gun. And, Franken, of course, was in the military for decades and will readily tell people that the guns being used in some of these mass shootings aren't that different from what he saw in war zones. So even if, this issue doesn't dominate the election all the way through, I do think it's smart for Franken to bring this stuff up because of that experience that he can point to and really draw a sharp contrast with Grassley.
Yeah. And again, I mentioned that I just came off the set with Mike Franken. This came up a little bit, and then also on the abortion thing, one of the things he said that was interesting to me And that I'll be interesting to observe as this campaign goes on, is that maybe on some of these issues, Republicans, I think the message from Mike Franken is be careful what you wish for, the dog that caught the car sort of thing, that maybe that hand has been overplayed now, and that now maybe abortion in particular he was talking about, but I think gun rights figure into that too, is has it gone past where most voters are, to the point where those issues could actually hurt Republicans in these elections and in a place like Iowa? I don't think we know the answer to that question yet, but it will be certainly interesting to monitor. The other thing I want to say real quick on this is, and speaking of pints and politics, there's a reason I always answer crystal ball questions with, I don't know, but because this came up, this bill, and I said, I just have a hard time seeing it pass, and it's always hard to get votes for legislation like this, and that was the last week, and now it's going to be on President Biden's desk by the end of the weekend. So shows you what I know. Don't bother asking me those kinds of questions. I'm useless. Moving on, speaking of crystal balls, what's going to happen with the Iowa caucuses? Also eons ago, Thursday morning, God, this week, Thursday morning, leaders in the Iowa Democratic Party took their turn making their case to the Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee as to why they, Iowa Democrats, believe they should remain an early voting state on the party's presidential nominating calendar. If you're just tuning into Iowa politics, a quick refresher, National Democrats have decided to shake up the process for picking their party's presidential preference. That alliteration was intentional, by the way. And Iowa and any other state that wants to be an early voting state has to make their case to national party leaders now as they redesigned that schedule. Tom, you covered the hearing. You listened in on the case they made. Give us a quick synopsis of the case that Iowa Democrats made, and why did they say that Iowa should remain first?
Yeah, so Iowa Democrats argued that the state offers a path to victory for long-shot candidates and opportunities for meaningful conversations with rural Americans and Iowans from every walk of life, again, as they made their pitch to hold on to their place at the front of the party's presidential nominating calendar. So again, Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Ross Wilburn told committee members that Iowa presents a unique opportunity for presidential candidates to connect with voters distributed across urban, rural, and suburban areas in what he deemed to be a presidential swing state, where a majority of congressional districts are competitive. So Iowa is among 16 states and Puerto Rico that are vying to be included in the Democrats' early presidential nominating window. The Rules Committee in the spring voted to reopen that nominating window, forcing all interested states, including the current early nominating states of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, to apply for a spot. And the move came after the current lineup of states came under increasing fire for a lack of diversity that many Democrats say doesn't represent the party's true strength. And so Iowa Democratic Party officials touted the state's pockets of diversity and argued that Iowa serves as an inexpensive and accessible playing field for lesser known candidates to establish themselves. So while Iowa is the sixth least diverse state in the country, Wilburn pointed to the urban demographics of Iowa's larger public school districts, notably the Des Moines School District, saying that in the last school year, according to their number of enrolled students, 34.7% were white, roughly 29% Hispanic, about 21% Black, and talked about how that when taken individually, these districts look a great deal more like America as a whole and reflects the future of Iowa. I I don't know how convincing, that argument was for members of the Rules Committee, talking about how there is diversity in Iowa. And Scott Brennan, former Iowa Democratic Party chairman, who's a member of the Rules and Bylaws Committee, also talked about how one of the forms of diversity that Iowa brings is the rural working class diversity, and that it's a group of folks that Democrats have forgotten how to talk to. He talked about, if national Democrats can't figure out how to talk to rural Americans, that under the Electoral College system, Democrats will be doomed to win the popular vote and lose the Electoral College, and called that criminal, and that that's something that Democrats need to figure out.
Tom, I had a question for you about some of that. Did when they were making their case, did they kind of talk at all about, the Iowa caucuses, especially in the Democratic Party, sometimes like being really beneficial for underdogs, like Obama or Sanders? Was that a point that came up?
Right. So that was a point that they stressed and they emphasized, is that Iowa is a place that levels the playing field for everybody, because the media market in Iowa is not as expensive. They mentioned, it gave a platform and an opportunity for Jimmy Carter, back in the 1970s. And then, of course, they, as you mentioned, talked about Barack Obama in 2008. And then they mentioned that in the 2020 cycle that candidates spent like $44 or $45 million in Iowa, in that the candidate that spent the most in Iowa was Tom Steyer, spending like $11 million or $12 million, compared to Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders, who spent considerably. Yes, and yet it was Buttigieg and Sanders who got the most traction and were able to really build momentum and make a name for themselves because of the opportunity that the Iowa caucuses provides to build your organizing, focus on the retail politicking, and how, again, that's maybe more important than, the media buys and the campaign ads. And then, of course, Buttigieg going on to win the Democratic caucuses in Iowa in 2020.
Yeah, that's a smart case to make. So it's interesting to hear them that they said that, because that is, if you talk about one of the things that you can say about Iowa, because there's certain things they can't fight, like the diversity. And I'll even give them points for the creative ways to say framed as, like, we're not diverse as a whole, but we have pockets that are quite diverse. So that's interesting. Todd, you also followed the proceedings, and I want to ask you, so we talked about what Iowa Democrats said. I'm curious to get your reaction, and it's kind of like when you used to cover a Supreme Court hearing before you knew how the vote was going to go, before it even started. And you would try to gauge how it's going to go based on the line of questioning from the justices, right? To give you a sense of how they're leaning. So in that sense here, based on any of the questions that were asked or the discussion that came up during Iowa's turn, were you able to get any sense from those National Democrats whether they're genuinely open to keeping Iowa early?
Well, they had a lot of questions about the new and improved caucus process and how the preference cards that are mailed in, how that's going to work and how the preferences will connect with delegate selection and who gets the shares of delegates and things like that, sort of technical kind of how's this going to work. I didn't, and they're, they did get there was at least one compliment for taking on the task of changing the caucuses. Someone that had been critical in the past said, I give you credit for trying to make it better. But I didn't sense a lot of enthusiasm for Iowa's first in the nation status. And I guess what's, is more telling is that I mean, I watched on Wednesday and a good part of Thursday. I mean, there's just this parade of states who are coming in there with these, with great presentations and great arguments. You know, Nevada came in, I think they were first on Wednesday, and basically, you know, they're a very diverse state. They have high union membership. You know, they check all the boxes.
They're competitive.
Yeah.
Competitive battleground state. I mean, they're, you know, Georgia came in and said, hey, we're the future of the Democratic Party. This is the place where the presidency was basically won last time, and it's going to be again. And I mean, there just were all sorts of strong arguments by all of these states why they're just a better choice to be up front and to be first. And that's what's going to hurt Iowa, I think, is that, you know, after hearing all that, I'm not sure how this Rules and Bylaws Committee can say, huh, yeah, you're all very diverse and you check all the boxes we wanted you to check, but yeah, we're going to stick with Iowa, I think. I just don't necessarily see that happening. But I mean, that doesn't mean it can't. And maybe they'll figure out a way to put Iowa someplace up in the front echelon. But it's just after, you know, I liked Iowa's presentation, but after seeing a lot of those others, it's like their case on the very, you know, the categories that the party says that they want these states to fill. It just, you know, they're just, these other states do a better job of filling those if the party's serious about changing the calendar.
And to that, Todd, I would add that, you know, Iowa is also under pressure from other Midwestern states to be kind of the regional representative. You've got Minnesota, Michigan, and Illinois as well making pitches to the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee. And I think Minnesota and Michigan in particular saying, you know, look, we're much more diverse than Iowa more competitive electorally, you know, they're much more consequential battleground states that, you know, kind of have more sway and are more, you know, influential than compared to Iowa. I mean, you know, when you look back to 2020 and other elections, you know, obviously Michigan and Minnesota, you know, much more competitive than Iowa, and you know, can make the argument that, you know, it still gives you an opportunity to make connections with urban, suburban, and rural voters. You know, you still get that opportunity to speak to rural America, but at the same time, consisting of larger populations of you know, segments of, you know, the Democratic base that you know, you just don't have in Iowa.
Well, Minnesota came in and said that they have the support of Democratic parties in Wisconsin and the Dakotas. So thanks, neighbors. But
this is why the Dakotas should just be combined into one state. They can't be trusted as separate states. They need to be combined and monitored closely.
That's true.
Oh, fantastic.
Do you also lump them together with Nebraska? Do you just create one huge?
The Plains megalopolis.
Yeah, there you go.
Be careful. You get too much input from outside the Midwest and Iowa will get thrown into that group too.
I guess if that happened also, then our tri-state coverage area would become like a quad state coverage area or something over here in Siouxland. I don't know.
We could become Midwest world.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Folks, this is a treat for you on the podcast. You're going to listen to an audible pulled live on the air here. I'm looking at the clock. And we had a few other things that we wanted to talk about, but there was just so much other stuff going on. I think I'm going to put a pin in these, and we'll come back to those next week when we can give them a little more oxygen, a little more time, and let you fine listeners get out and enjoy the rest of their weekend. So we'll pause here and call it for this edition of On Iowa Politics.
But what about the planned U.S.-Russian war that's going to break out next Friday morning?
Yeah, that's let's spend the week trying to figure out what's going to break at 9 o'clock next Friday morning, right before.
What about the aliens that are going to land next next Friday morning?
Goodness gracious! Oh man! But that's it for this week. We hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, tell your friends and subscribe to us wherever you find your podcasts. Fan mail can be sent to podcasts@thegazette.com. And now that you've listened to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll get all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. And I hope you caught this morning's, because I had some things that I wanted to say about some former colleagues at the Gazette. So if you're not a subscriber, find someone who is and have them forward that to you. And you can subscribe to the On Iowa Politics newsletter at thegazette.com. And don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Sioux City Journal, Mason City Globe Gazette, Muscatine Journal, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Porch Builders will play us out this week. If you know an Iowa band or musician who should be featured on the podcast, please send us a sound file. For Tom, Jared, Todd, and our producer, Stephen, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thanks for listening.
Get a daily update from the Gazette with our daily news podcast. Add it to your podcast player or your Alexa-friendly device to get a bite-sized local news update each day. Check it out at thegazette.com/podcasts.